Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
A new monument was dedicated this weekend in Lakeside to the Cedar Fire victims and survivors on this anniversary of the worst firestorm in California history. Today, we will devote our entire show to replaying our award-winning special report that originally aired in 2013 for the 10-year anniversary of the Cedar Fire. Today, we present a special report on the Cedar Fire. A decade ago, the firestorm began with a lost hunter's signal flare in a rugged East County canyon during the late afternoon of October 25, 2003. During the night, it roared into Ramona, Lakeside, and other communities, scorching a terrifying path across our entire region. In the end, the fire burned 280,000 acres, or 438 square miles. It destroyed 2,800 buildings, including 2,200 homes, and killed 15 people. 10 years later, the Cedar Fire still stands as the worst wildfire in California history. The fire destroyed dreams and extinguished hopes. Yet, from the ashes, many have built new lives. The fire has sparked reforms aimed at making us safer and improving notifications during future emergencies, though there is still a long way to go on that journey to protect us all, since authorities agree it isn't a question of if, but when the next wildfire will strike in our fire-prone region. As we commemorate the 10-year anniversary of the Cedar Fire, it's important to speak with those who remember that event so that we will never forget. At East County Magazine, we've spent the past few weeks interviewing survivors and eyewitnesses to the Cedar Fire, as well as fire officials who recall what it was like to battle a blaze that transcended all that they had known before. A firestorm that tore apart families, yet drew together communities. Here now are their stories, the voices of the Cedar Fire. First up, Captain Mike Moeller with CAL FIRE shares his memories.
In 2003, I actually was with CAL FIRE, Riverside County Fire. I was here on a strike team, actually on an engine, and we were here for about 2.5 weeks on the Cedar Fire. If you talk to any firefighter, depending on where you were on that fire, you'll never forget it. It was a career fire, is what we say sometimes. The fire activity, the fire conditions, and then the enormity of the size of the fire alone.
Where exactly were you during the fire?
I was up near Miramar Air Force Base there, near the airfield, where it actually had jumped the 15 freeway when we got there. Then we were moved over to Scripps Ranch.
Was that really surprising to you that a fire could move that quickly? I think a lot of people were shocked to wake up that morning. I certainly was. And to see that this thing that started during the night was already burned into the urban areas of San Diego.
Yes, it was. And we saw a wind-driven fire. In fact, when we were coming into the county and seeing some of the fire run along the freeway, it was actually moving faster than we were on the freeway. It looked like a war zone when we pulled into the county. There was heroic actions, not only by your public safety employees, but the way that San Diego reacted, civilians helping each other, was such a devastating wildfire. We saw acts of kindness and bravery throughout the county just from civilians. So when we see such a devastating wildfire, it was the human kindness that we saw out there was pretty amazing.
Dr. Mark Hansen and his family live in Lakeside in Wildcat Canyon. Mark is the CEO of the nonprofit Heartland Coalition, the publisher of East County Magazine. He's here to tell us about their harrowing experience the night of the Cedar Fire. Now, Mark, the night that it occurred, you were working late. It was 3 o'clock or so in the morning. What was the first inkling you had that something was wrong?
I was in the south turret of our house, but I could smell smoke. There just seemed to be a lot of heavy wind. I called the fire department. They assured me not to worry. It was in Ramona, moving north to Julian. And I called again 20 minutes later, and just to double check, they said, oh no, just go to sleep.
They told you to go to sleep?
Yeah.
And when you looked out your window across the lake below your house, Lake San Vicente, what did you see?
Flames 300 feet high.
30-story building.
My wife, she asked me, I said, oh, they said it's in Ramona going north. And she looked out and said, it's in Ramona all right, but it's only just across the lake. It's only a quarter of a mile.
A quarter of a mile, and they told you to go to sleep.
Right.
And then what did you tell the 911 operator?
I called and told her that there's been a terrible mistake, that the fire is approaching rapidly, and they weren't aware of it, but would check into it. And
did they ever activate reverse 911 for your community?
Oh, they did, but before the next fire, not
but not
this
in that
one.
Fire. So no. People there in the middle of the night had absolutely no warning that this inferno was roaring toward them. So what did you do next?
I called neighbors, and we left messages, spoke to four, and then all the lines went out. The last neighbor
the phone lines burned.
We spoke to said, oh, you can come watch it over at our house. And my wife screamed that this isn't like that. Look out the window. And that person barely got out, was the last person to get out. At the bottom of Muth Valley Road, there were about 18 cars there, and people thought maybe they had hauled them out, but that's how badly they were burned. The firemen miraculously got everybody out of the cars, kicking and screaming because all their belongings.
But it was burning tires.
Tires burned the tires and very shortly exploded it and burned the cars, not while anyone was in it.
You did a great heroic job of getting a lot of people out with these middle of the night phone calls as you were trying to evacuate your own family. Were you able to salvage much?
Oh, no. My wife took what pets she could, an iguana, one cat, her favorite cat. Ran to the basement. We couldn't find it. We got the dog. The horses all got out. We took them across the way.
And you had a young daughter at the time.
And Hillary, yeah, she's the only one who got any pictures. And she was a freshman at El Capitan High School at the time. She got her ASB shirt she'd need and her volleyball uniform and her homework. Mm-hmm. I got all the bills. My wife grabbed her brand new Mac laptop, but all the files were on the old one. Mm-hmm. She realized she made a bad choice.
So were you seeing this fire? How close was the fire as you were driving out of Muth Valley Road?
It was only 100 yards away in our guest house was artist Ryan Mims, and he didn't want to leave his artwork behind. So we got that together. We felt for sure that guest house would burn, and a large house, fireproof, it's going to still be there.
It had steel framing.
Not the case. It was just the reverse. Of the large houses, almost all of them burned. Of the guest houses, about 50% remained because flames coming at 60 miles an hour would ricochet off. 3,000 degrees.
3,000?
2,000 less than Hiroshima.
Wow. That
so nobody was able to stand out with the garden hose. One person did. They only found steel-tipped boots. One neighbor, all they found was his teeth. His brother came down from Oregon to identify that. Others tried to drive to the lake. They only found bones and charred cars. Very, very hot. It was a 100-year fire.
Muth Valley is part of Wildcat Canyon,
yes,
which was the scene of the great tragedy in this fire where 12 people lost their lives.
Correct.
Were these friends, neighbors, Mark?
Seven of them I knew very well because they were close neighbors.
That had to be just devastating for the community afterwards. What was it like coming back in there after the fire?
The first thing is that you were alive and many of the neighbors weren't. The second is the surprise at all the rules about fire, because this fire was a firestorm. It was little hurricanes, and it was surprising what did or didn't survive. All the young horses all died because they either tried to charge the fire, run away. Mm-hmm. The older ones who dodged it lived a while but had lung damage. The folks who had cleaned up their yards, thought they would be safe, didn't make a bit of difference.
We should add, defensible space does help
it
in
does.
Many places.
It does. In the 2007 fire, it helped a great deal. And the key is if it's under 1,600 degrees. After 1,600 degrees in a firestorm, all the bets are off. It's blowing up rocks. Your little sprinkler system on your house will just be a steam bath. The fireman came up, and one of the firemen was a former student, and he was going to save my house. But 10,000 gallons would delay the burning for 30 seconds.
Now, you and your family were fortunate that you had insurance and you were able to rebuild. How have your neighbors fared?
Those who did not have insurance coverage that was replacement insurance didn't fare well because all of the court cases were lost by the homeowners. The insurance company won them, and that was 6 and 7 years later when the verdicts came in. So that was gut-wrenching.
How did they lose?
The laws were written in the favor of the insurance companies and the lobbyists. And Heartland Coalition, the group I'm executive director of, got grants to help people rebuild, especially their home businesses. We did seminars in productivity, communication.
I remember you raised funds also for cars, computers, to help a lot of these people get back on their feet and rebuild their lives.
Of all the people who applied for SBA loans, we were one of very few that got them. It takes about 4 years. And so many people, if they didn't have enough insurance, maybe they thought they could get it from an SBA loan, but they always check on the tax returns, and they got these threatening letters that they had underreported their income. It was rough in many ways.
Why do you think this fire got so out of control so fast?
There were lots of fires in the area, and our planes that are normally at Ramona were in Riverside or San Bernardino.
Now, you lost a stable also, and I remember you telling me an interesting story about what you had to do to prove it was even there to the insurance company.
Oh, yeah, that was the tack room. The fire was so hot, it was like Flash Gordon had been there and disintegrated it. But I walked 50 feet to the west, and all of the paint from the stable was there on the ground. And then we went back, we found the cornerstones, and we found one little metal top for the saddle horn. And where it was made, it was a really nice saddle.
And that was the evidence they needed, because they were denying this claim at first for a stable.
Well, you don't see fires like this.
Fire not only takes a toll financially, physically, but also emotionally. Are there still scars, emotional scars from this fire that you and your family and your neighbors have to this day, Mark?
Absolutely. All the horses died up where we were, except for four we had on the other side who were older, who actually would look at where these little cyclones were coming and dodge it. Many people were very sad about that. Many people in these support groups who had cats. Mm-hmm. Many people...
You lost a cat as well.
Yeah, my wife has a little graveyard for it, and other pets have been there. Of course, if someone lost a family member, that it was far over anything else. One of our neighbors lost, they were all gone. It was the husband, the wife, and the children. So disappeared, and it was a terrible blow in that way. Another thing that happened is there was a lot of behavior from some insurance companies, not others. Others were terrible. Some went in and told people they were underinsured, but they signed all these papers. We'll cover you to this amount, a little, which is about half of what they needed to really rebuild. The other problem had to do with people stealing all the copper, all the piping. They'd try to irrigate and the water would run out. All their trees died. Another problem had to do with the financing. Many of them got more money than they'd had before to rebuild. But people came in with all kinds of great ideas and investments, and they lost it.
Wow, so there's a lot of predatory actions out there.
Absolutely. And of course, when I said great ideas, they turned out not to be great. Some were not fraudulent, but they were high-risk things like second mortgages at the time, and those people lost all their money. So that's a lesson of being conservative in tough times. People were vulnerable, and it's not everybody's recovered yet.
It's a very long road to recovery after these fires, and we appreciate you taking the time to tell us about your experience.
Yes, I learned a lot from the people we helped at Heartland, over 158 people, and made a lot of close friends.
Chief Andy Parr with the Lakeside Fire Department has been fighting fires in Lakeside for 34 years. Now take us back to that night on October 25th, 2003. When you first found out about the fire, did you realize early on that this could become such a huge disaster?
I don't think anybody recognized the complexity or the size of the disaster when it first started, but I think it's safe to say that fire managers did know about the fire prior to the arrival of the winds. We in Lakeside thought it was far away, but we still were keeping an eye on a fire far out in the Cleveland National Forest. I actually drove to an area, a high point in the Vieos Indian Reservation, could see the fire quite well from that location, but it was a small fire and didn't have too much concern. But we did keep our ear on the radio traffic about the fire, and when the winds arrived in the mountainous areas, the fire increased in intensity greatly. At that point, I came back to work, and we initiated a callback for additional crews to respond back into the station to help us staff the department.
A decision at the time was made, not by your department, not to do water drops. It was getting dark, and in those days, they didn't allow the helicopters to fly after dark. That's one thing that has changed. When did you become aware that this fire was spreading out of control and could be a threat to your area?
Well, throughout the evening, I would listen to the radio traffic, and I heard a lot of the familiar voices. Many of us grew up together. We've been in the fire service a long time. It's not just Lakeside. It's all of the partners working together. When familiar voices that I know and trust are speaking in rapid cadence, I knew that there was something that I should be alerted to. And the fire location was far from Lakeside, and there was little chance, based on our experience, that the fire would be able to travel that far in a night time. That might be the next day or the day after for a fire to get that big during that time.
And how fast did it travel?
Well, it traveled very fast. Later on in the evening, when the fire was in the Wildcat Canyon area north and east of San Vicente Reservoir, I'm told that the fire burned 58,000 acres an hour, which ended up being later on calculated to be the fastest fire spread of a fire that had ever been recorded.
58,000 acres an hour. So overnight, this thing leapt from Lakeside, lickety-split across the 52 corridor, and before we knew it, had burned into the urban core areas of central San Diego. What happened during the night when you realized that Wildcat Canyon was liable to be devastated?
Wildcat Canyon is an area of scattered homes that were nestled in amongst very thick and old brush. And the brush in California, of course, is very hazardous and very flammable. And we, as a fire agency, would work with our neighbors and our residents year after year to complete defensible space coverage to some success in those areas. But we knew that the fire load was really heavy there because we hadn't had a fire there for many years. And it seemed like a perfect storm for us to have that fire heading towards Barona, which would then feed it into Lakeside pretty fast, primarily the Wildcat Canyon area. And we knew that we needed to get crews in there right away. And this all occurred in the very early morning hours.
Right, and there were no warnings for residents back then. A lot of people never got in reverse 911. There was no TV reports. We didn't have our wildfire and emergency alerts or the various NCSOL and sheriff alerts that are out there. So people were truly caught unawares, literally sleeping in their beds.
Many people were caught unaware, and that was really troubling for me as a fire chief that had that division of the fire. By that time, the fire had gotten so big that we had started with different divisions of the fire, Ramona, Lakeside, Julian, those kinds of areas where junior managers were working different areas for command and control issues. We knew that fire was going to race through Wildcat, and we really thought we needed to get in there and wake people up. And so we ordered equipment that we could. We had needs for many more fire engines, but the roughly seven fire companies of Lakeside and other agencies that came to our aid on the call were able to get to many, many homes. We wanted to systematically get to as many houses as we could before they were overtaken by the fire. And we were able to get to many of those, but there's always the measure of how much, how far, how long. Now that you've arrived at the house and you say, is anybody home? Well, by that time, most of the power was out, so the houses are all dark. It was not only frightening, it was very disconcerting because you would knock on the door and you would really wonder, how long should I stay? What if they're a deep sleeper? But you know what? Maybe they're on a holiday in Florida. We just don't know. Right. So the fire crews all took what they thought was a reasonable person standard, which was, I'll do the best I can, but we're certainly not going to stay here very long because we have many more houses to get to.
Right.
And when people say, hey, I never got notified or I did get notified or whatever, I say, well, you know what? We did the best we could at the time, and we stand by those.
Certainly the worst tragedy, the fire, was the 12 lives that were lost in Wildcat Canyon. But if not for your efforts, it certainly would have been many more, it sounds like.
We think so. And that's not to say we did a great job and we saved a lot of lives. I believe that's true. But we feel really badly about the 12 people who passed away in Wildcat Canyon, that we weren't able to do more. Some of it was their choices. Some of it was a lot of the other factors that were in play there. What I would say, though, is that, you know, at the end of the day, I would have told you that maybe five times that number was what I was really expecting to find the next morning. And to know that it was 12 was devastating, but I knew that it could have been much, much worse.
Yeah, and you were working with firefighters, not only local ones, but you've mentioned many who were from out of the area who didn't know all these back roads and byways.
That's right. We did have firefighters from other areas that didn't know those, but we were good about putting our people with their people. And we also had law enforcement officers of different agencies, CHP, the Sheriff's Department. Mm-hmm. I believe we had Border Patrol. Of course, we didn't just have folks that perished and folks that survived. We also had those folks that were injured in escaping the fire. We had people who were burned. We were forced to evacuate them. And then, of course, everyone's best friend, the dogs, the cats, and the parrots and other animals.
Horses.
And again, all in the middle of the night.
It's almost unimaginable, the scale and the scope of this fire.
Exactly.
For those who lost family members, the scars of the Cedar Fire run deepest of all. Molly Sloan lost a daughter, her daughter-in-law, and her granddaughter. She and other family members came to the Lakeside Memorial Service October 26th with photos to display in tribute to their loved ones, Mary Pierce, Robin Sloan, and Jennifer Sloan, a student at El Capitan High School. Molly drove through thick smoke, surrounded by flames, to escape the fire in Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon in the middle of the night. Other family members were supposed to follow in their own cars, but never made it out. Molly told us the smoke was so thick she couldn't see anything in front of her. "I don't know how I got out, and they didn't," she told us. The family never rebuilt. Molly owned the property and had given homes to each of her children, but she was too traumatized to return. Instead, she's let the land go back to nature. But her grandson, Dante Perry III, said he loves the place where he grew up, and he hopes to rebuild on the site someday. Mary Peace left behind two children, who recently lost their father to cancer. Her daughter, Becky, is now in college in Oregon, studying to be a nurse. Her son, Charlie, works in the lumber business in Washington State. Molly told us he has a nice family, two little boys. One just lost his first tooth, she said, smiling. The circle of life goes on. Rudy Reyes was the worst burned victim of the Cedar Fire. He was burned over 65% of his body, and yet amazingly he survived. He's gone on to be not a victim, but a survivor, someone who has become an inspiration to other burned victims and an advocate for improving fire safety and fire protection. The night of the fire, October 25th, 2003, Rudy had been to a Halloween party, unaware that the Cedar Fire had already started in a remote canyon. He came home, went to bed at his home in Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon, and was awakened by the smell of smoke at 3:30 in the morning.
I was 27. I had built my own place, and my sister ends up coming to the door and telling me to evacuate. And I turn on the light, there's no lights.
Power was
out. So I get myself dressed in the darkness, go downstairs, and my sister's like, there's a fire coming, get out. Well, what about Mom? Mom says she's going to stay, plenty of fires, don't worry about it. Well, if I'm going to evacuate, I'm not going to let my mom stay. So I ran up to her house. She's telling me, I'm going to stay in bed, don't worry, plenty of fires have been on this mountain and never come to this side. And I go, Mom, you don't understand. So basically, I kick down the door, I pull her out of bed and bring her out to the porch. She sees a fire on the other side of the hill. And she goes, don't worry, it's not going to come over here, I told you. And I go, no. And as you look to the side, like we're looking between us, you could see a little red ember falling. And I go, look, if you see that, we're in the fallout zone. It's coming here next. So basically, I grab her, throw her in a truck, and make her leave.
Okay.
Do the same with my brother up there and the person who was renting my room. By the time I got down to my place, the fire had moved from the other side of the mountain and was coming up ours. It was so close that I jump in my car, turn it over, and nothing. The fireman explained to me that in a super mega fire, there's no oxygen, not even to create the spark in a spark plug. All the oxygen is being consumed by the fire. I look around in my car, and I'm figuring I can stay in the car. It's glass, it's metal. I'll be okay in here. The fire's moving fast. It'll rush over. And in the back of my head, a voice goes, no. If you stay in this car, they're going to find you no better than a roast. And I can see my house isn't on fire yet. Just the top corner of the roof is smoldering. So I run into my house, open the door, look around. Fortunately, downstairs I had left thick corduroy pants, a sleeve shirt. So now I have on some extra clothing. Now I jump in the shower with all my clothes. Now I come out completely drenched wet, and I look up at the roof, and it was those old rafter-style roofs. The whole thing looked like water, blue, because the complete roof was on fire.
Wow.
Okay?
You must have been terrified.
Oh, yeah. So now I know I can't go upstairs anymore. I got to figure out what I'm doing. I got to leave my house. So I walk out of my house, say goodbye to the house I'd built. I can see the road going down to the main road. Well, we had 10-foot clearances required by law. There was a tunnel for me to get out. Now I'm thinking, hey, if I was a 12-year-old kid and there was a bus waiting right there, I could make this run in 15, 20 seconds. I can do this. That's the area that was on fire.
So you were going to have to run
through it.
Through the wall?
Through the fire, yes. So
how big, how tall was this wall?
We're talking 20, 30-foot flames. The area that I decided to run down wasn't on fire, but I was surrounded by fire. I psyched myself up for it, and I covered my face, and when I hit that fire line, all I knew was to run, and I knew where my road was. And I just kept looking down while covering my face with my hands. Well, if you look at my face and hands where my injuries are, you'll notice my left-hand pointer finger and my ear, they're matching. It's because the fire was coming from this angle.
Took the worst of it in some ways.
Yes, they saved my face. I'm running through the fire. I see fire lick up my face once, and I start to slow down when the muscles no longer want to move because extreme heat or cold. My body starts to want to stop, and I'm going, no, if I stop now, that's it. So I remember kicking my legs and getting myself moving, and next thing you know, I come out the other side. As I come out of the fire, I look at myself, and again, I was wet. I wasn't on fire. So I'm thinking, I'm okay. Now it's 3:30 in the morning. You can't see anything.
Right.
There's no real light. So I walk down to the road, and I figured I gotta wait. somebody's going to come by and pick me up and I'll be okay. And like 15 minutes passed and I started to get disorientated, dizzy. And I said, if I pass out, they're going to find me dead in the morning. So I just started walking down Wildcat. I get about a mile, maybe a mile and a half, when lights, car from behind, and I almost get hit by a white truck. He honks his horn, flashes his lights, and goes around me.
Unbelievable.
Okay, I get another quarter mile, and next thing I know, here come lights again. I flag the person down, and this lady lowers down her window from her driver's side and says, "You get in this dang car right now," like she's my mom, upset. I get in the car, and she tells me, "We got to get you to a paramedic." "No, you got to get me my family." "No, I got to get you to a paramedic." She's going to get them. I look at myself and take a quick assessment. So I look at my arms. I think, I can think. I'm not in much pain. I can talk.
Because it burned the nerves, so you couldn't feel.
So I come walking out of the vehicle. I see her with the paramedic coming, and I tell the paramedic, "Hey, go find somebody that needs your help more than me. I'm conscious. I'm fine." He takes out his flashlight, goes down and up real fast, and goes, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. You don't see what I see right now, and you'd better let me help you."
Amazing.
So I walk over to the paramedic unit. They cut my clothes off, and they tell me we're putting you to sleep so that you don't feel any pain.
And when did you wake up?
I woke up 2 months later. I was induced into 2 months worth of a coma because they explained that the pain would have been so intense I probably wouldn't have made it. By the time I woke up, they had taken off my ear, amputated a finger. I've now had about 50 surgeries done.
Did you have any idea where you were or what
now,
had happened?
Now, you want to talk about a coma dreams. You remember, you understand, you hear.
Do you have memories of things that doctors said or
And your mind
said?
Is trying to connect it and make it make as much logical sense as possible.
So when you finally did come out of the coma.
Now you deal with the pain. My fingers were burnt to the bone and the doctors wanted to amputate. My mom wouldn't let them and it was up to me. I was blinking to communicate.
And you said no, so you still have your fingers.
120 some odd yards of cadaver skin were used to keep me around.
You've really gone out and done some very positive things with your life since then.
When I was sitting in bed thinking, is this going to be life? Can I no longer move? That was scary. And then as you make progress, you know, I had to teach myself to do everything from eating because my fingers don't work to walking.
Did you have health insurance?
No. I'm still living Social Security Medi-Cal. With this much injury, a lot of companies won't hire me. So what I decided to do was make the best of it. I said, look, this isn't about me. There's a lot of us in San Diego that are injured. We all need to heal.
So you've gone out and you've become an advocate for improving fire prevention, fire safety. You've also been an advocate for burn victims.
The San Diego Burn Institute. I'm constantly trying to support them as much as I can because they supported me when I needed them. My first year, I didn't know what it was like and I was really alone. And I went to this gathering they called World Burn Congress. They pulled together families of burn survivors to help you come out and see and understand that others are dealing with also. From that point, I made it my point to go back to the hospital and allow other burn survivors, even in hospitals, say, hey, look, touch. It's going to be okay. It's going to heal.
And you've run for office?
Yes. And the big reason why I run, if these politicians aren't going to do their job, someone like us needs to step up and do it for them. I've testified in front of the supervisors. I've testified in front of Congress. I've made a lot of friends. And don't get me wrong, I've made some powerful enemies in the fact that I've been vocal. But we need somebody to be vocal for this community.
What are some of the changes you've seen that you think have helped to make us safer?
Just the communications alone. Just the fact that we're actually able to organize ourselves in a better fashion. We're on Facebook as a party chat line for fires.
Brush Fire Party Line out here in Lakeside.
Correct.
Where citizens get on there and they post about fires happening. And I've even started a call bank. If one person learns about a fire,
yep.
They're going to be calling, yep. Waking up their neighbors.
Yep.
So the community really does seem to be rallying around.
Stepping up,
out here in Lakeside.
That's right.
Now, you were a student at the time. Were you able to go back and finish your education?
I've received 2 degrees in archaeology now. I've also been ordained as a reverend.
Do you find yourself asking ever, why me?
You'll never know the answer to why. And it only hurts to ask. So once you realize that, you kind of stop asking why. And
yeah.
You move on, you accept. And acceptance is a big key.
What advice would you offer to other burn victims or fire survivors out there?
Okay, let me give you the 2 scenarios I see. One is for that family on their last minute. There's an emergency happening and you don't know what to take. Take the bare essentials. Get out with your life. Be glad that you left and didn't get injured.
Very wise words.
Okay. To the ones that have survived a major traumatic event, count your blessings. Don't look at the negativity. Make the best of what you have.
You are listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
In Scripps Ranch, where a 10-year commemoration of the Cedar Fire was held, Supervisor Diane Jacobs spoke on the resiliency of Cedar Fire survivors and of her recent visit through Harbison Canyon, one of the worst burned areas in the Cedar Fire.
The fire swept through there, destroyed almost all of the homes, suffered many losses, and I remember going out right afterwards and standing on a picnic table amongst all the rubble and devastation. Gathered around me were the people who had lived in those homes. And I shared with them the commitment to provide as many of the resources we could to help in the recovery effort, and we did. But I also shared with them that I knew that East County residents are very resilient and that we would rise from those ashes stronger and better than ever before. And what I saw today driving through Harbison Canyon was exactly that. That community, it looks better than ever before. It is better than ever before. There were neighbors who never talked to each other before the Cedar Fire. There were neighbors who didn't even know each other. But that fire brought together that community and many other communities, and they're working together. And as a region, as a result of the Cedar Fire, we're working together in partnership more than ever before.
County supervisors spent over $286 million since 2003 to improve fire safety, including firefighting aircraft, better communications, and creating a county fire authority to consolidate rural fire agencies. While many improvements have been made, the system has not been without its glitches. We asked Supervisor Jacob about recent reports indicating some rural fire stations have been closed with dark days even during fire season, and this is the promise that she made.
Every one of those fire stations are manned 24/7, and that will be done, guaranteed.
Councilman Mark Kersey talked about improvements the city has made in fire protection for its residents.
The Cedar Fire was very definitely a defining moment for this community. Many San Diegans came to the aid of both Scripps Ranch and Tierra Santa to help. We learned a lot about our resiliency as a city and discovered a few gaps. Since 2003, there were several changes that the city made. There were several measures passed by the City Council meant to fire harden new construction. Woodshake shingles were banned on new construction or roof replacements. New construction is now required to have boxed eaves or no eaves. Double glazed windows and A-rated siding is now required. Codes were changed to require 100 feet of defensible space around homes in fire-prone areas. This was previously at 65 feet. New code protects homes better and provides firefighters a wider area to work to defend structures. The fire department also increased the number of code compliance officers who do these inspections from 2 at the time of the Cedar Fire to 7 officers today. They're responsible for a comprehensive door-to-door brush inspection program of 45,000 properties on canyon rims throughout the city. Finally, after the Cedar Fire, the city established its Community Emergency Response Team program, or CERT. Today, there are 14 CERT teams and 1,500 volunteers trained citywide to assist their community in the event of a major emergency. As we reflect on the 10th anniversary of the Cedar Fire, I also really want to give a special thanks to the San Diego Fire Department and all they do every day to protect our communities. We learned a lot from the Cedar Fire, but I know that we are a stronger community for it.
Assemblyman Brian Jones was a freshman Santee City Councilman when the Cedar Fire struck. Speaking at the 10-year anniversary of the Cedar Fire at the Lakeside Fire Station, he recalled waking up during the Cedar Fire and seeing that the sky was orange. He arranged a tour with a fire official that day, starting in El Monte Valley, heading toward the San Vicente Reservoir.
We couldn't get through because the fires that were already coming through El Monte Road, there were already houses on fire. So that was already startling enough, but then to see multiple houses on fire and yards on fire and things that don't look like they should burn, burning. And as we kept trying to get through, there was a herd of deer trying to get away from the fire and jumped right in front of our car. We came back out and then we drove up Wildcat Canyon Road and the fire had come through there. And it looked like a war zone. Just tree trunks left burning. And, of course, the fire touched each one of us individually and amongst our families. One of my very best friends, father-in-law, actually died in the Mute Valley in his RV as he was trying to escape the fire and was caught in the fire. And eventually, by that evening, the fire had come up to Santee and was burning back. It was on the city limits of Santee, and our firefighters had put up a line against the fire there, and I was spending more time with the fire chief and the professionalism of the firefighters and the professionalism of the law enforcement became real to me that day. That these ladies and gentlemen have committed their lives to protect us, and they do it every single day.
Assemblyman Jones and a representative from Senator Joel Anderson's office presented a commemoration to the Lakeside Fire Department, which was commemorating not only the 10-year anniversary of the Cedar Fire, but also celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Lakeside Fire Department. Mark Ostrander, a retired Cal Fire Battalion Chief, has been serving East County for many years. Now he tells us about the heroic actions of some volunteer firefighters during the Cedar Fire that may have prevented another catastrophe. While all the focus was on what was happening up in Lakeside and Ramona and other areas, I understand a fire broke out in Jewel Valley, south of Boulevard. Tell us what happened.
Well, I was the only available resource on the south end of the county there. I was on duty working on another assignment for a staging area at McCain Camp for crews to rest and whatnot. I was getting ready to set that up. A fire broke out in the Jewel Valley area. It was small at the time. I show up, gave a report to the ECC. Nobody even knew it was there. I happened to see it. I asked for more resources, and I told my closest resources were coming out of Nevada.
Nevada. So it was just you. So it was just you. You were in Jewel Valley. The nearest help was coming from Nevada. So what did you do, local firefighter here with no help on the way, anytime in the next few hours?
I had a local volunteer group show up. They were out of Hakumba. And I believe there was also a couple of Boulevard volunteers with the group. We came up with a plan. Border Patrol was there. I gave them the keys to one of the stations, said, go grab some hose. The railroad was there, and they had a water tank up on the hill. Mm-hmm. And we used that water and that engine and those volunteers to hold the fire small until about daylight hours when we finally got some more help in. They broke some engines loose from the Otay fire to come out to help us.
So the volunteer firefighters from Boulevard and Hakumba worked through the night, along with some Border Patrol people, to stop this fire or hold it and keep it small. What would have happened if you guys hadn't been there?
Well, there was nothing I could do as an individual. If I was there by myself, I could try to, and I would have tried to do what I could, but that fire would have got up into the wind. It would have came up out of the canyon, and it more than likely would have been a very large fire heading in the same direction as Cedar.
Burned into the urban areas of San Diego, in other words.
Correct.
Now, you also worked the Harris Fire, which started in Potrero, very close to the Campo Boulevard area out here. Were a fire to start east of Potrero, in Hakumba or Boulevard, one of these areas where these stations have been dark, could that, in your opinion, funnel through and burn just like the Harris Fire did?
Yes. It's in an area where it's conducive for fire to travel to the west in a Santa Ana event.
A lot's been done to try to improve safety since then. Here's what CAL FIRE Captain Mike Moeller had to say.
Some of the things that we've seen since the Cedar, and remember, anytime we have a large fire or any type of incident, the fire department always learns what can we do better. We've seen improvement in communications across the board, not only CAL FIRE, but also with our cooperators throughout the county. We have several fire agencies, the support of the Board of Supervisors. We have new technology on our aircraft, increased staffing, increased equipment. Our county fire chiefs work collectively on a monthly basis to determine and go off of reports from the Cedar Fire. And I really think that we've come leaps and bounds since that, and it's evident on just an initial response that we see every day.
What else should the public know to be as prepared as possible for an emergency or an evacuation?
We have a program. It's called Ready, Set, Go. It's under readyforwildfire.org. Are you really ready? Take a look at your home. Do you have the important papers? Remember, if you are evacuated and you can't get home, do you have your medications, important documents, contact numbers? You may be away for a couple weeks that you can't access your home. Exercise that plan with your family. I know we talk about it. Yes, we're prepared, but are you really prepared? Does your family really know? What if you're not home? Where's your family going to meet? Make sure you have a phone tree. And make sure your yard is prepared. We always talk about that defensible space.
Mm-hmm. Crucial.
It is crucial. And unfortunately, we can't put a fire engine at every house. But when a fire engine or a strike team goes into an area, they do what's called triage. They're going to look at homes. And homes that have defensible space, what we're asking is you provide the offense. When an engine gets there, we'll provide the defense. That gives us that fighting opportunity
Very
to
important.
Protect your home.
because not having that defensible space not only makes the house vulnerable, but it puts firefighters at risk if they were to try to go into a dense tangle of brush and try to save that.
That's correct. And a simple thing is have a very visible address, even use reflective material if possible.
Yeah, I've heard too that it's a good idea to put a big sign on the garage door if you have a water source on the property that firefighters can use. Is that helpful to you?
It is. And what we'll do when we talk about that triage, the strike team will go in and they'll actually survey the area. So yes, if there's some way you can mark that you do have some type of water source, that is great, but please don't let it slow you down if you are asked to evacuate.
You're not directly involved with the County Fire Authority, but CAL FIRE itself is, and we've heard mixed reviews, some places where it's working out pretty well and some other places where there have been some issues. What can be done to better protect people?
As your listeners know, yes, CAL FIRE and San Diego County Fire Authority are one. Mm-hmm. We are merging the stations. In fact, that's one of the improvements since the Cedar Fire is that we don't have all these separate entities. We'll bring them under one umbrella, same training, same communication, same response. We want to have staffed fire stations.
We've talked a lot about things that have improved since the Cedar Fire, and a lot has gotten better. I think. Are there areas that you think still need some improvement? And if so, what changes would you ideally like to see happen?
Economic times funding is always something that we look at as far as maybe additional firefighters, additional equipment. Right now, I think where we're heading, and again, with the support of the Board of Supervisors right now, our technology is continued updating of technology. We're using a new system called NICS, which is our Next Generation Incident Command System. That funding is coming. But I think technology-wise, as we keep improving, that would be my magic wand, is we're seeing it happen, but it takes some time for it to get there.
How likely do you think, with all the efforts that have been made, that we could have someday another Cedar Fire?
Well, I don't think it's a question of if. I can tell you it's going to be when. Unfortunately, where we live, the Mediterranean-type climate here in San Diego, the conditions, the Santa Ana winds, we will have another large wind-driven fire, but it's about preparation. 94% of all wildland fires are human-caused. That doesn't mean it was arson, but it could be negligence, just not doing the right thing at the right time. It's inevitable we're going to have a fire. Yeah. But prevention, we want to remind the public, is everybody's job, not just the firefighters, but the public too.
We're back with Chief Parr from Lakeside. 10 years have passed. What things have improved? What have we learned from the Cedar Fire?
We have a better coordination system amongst agencies. I think fire chiefs know that they can't do it alone. In San Diego County, we are blessed or cursed, which way, depending on how you look at it, with many small fire departments, all with their own fire chief and command structure. That provides additional resources and managers on the ground, but it also provides a possibility for some errors in communication. I'd like to put them in two categories. We have the category of what I think of as a natural disaster style fire, which the Cedar Fire clearly was, wind driven with heavy fuel fire that the firefighters really had no chance of putting out that day. We really had more of a opportunity to save lives and property around the fringes of those natural disaster areas, and the firefighters did what they could, as compared to the fires that we have alongside the roads or things like that on a frankly everyday basis somewhere in our county. I think we've done a better job in managing those fires.
We've also had improvements in communications.
We have. We had at the time, and we still have, but it's more robust than ever before, as an 800 megahertz communication system for all kinds of public agencies. In a fire the size of Cedar or these other large fires, we have hundreds of firefighters that come from outside of the county that don't have access to our 800 megahertz system. So fire agencies routinely revert back to a VHF channel. So we are able to split off the 800 megahertz and the VHF bands, increasing actually our ability to communicate amongst public safety agencies.
Are we seeing better coordination among the fire agencies, more air power?
Certainly the fire agency coordination is better. It wasn't bad before. We were actually very good friends, worked closely together. We have been able to group our folks together and come up with common policies and procedures, and that's a good thing. The air power piece, of course, in Lakeside, which is fairly small department. We don't have air power. We rely on the sheriff's department, which has CAL FIRE personnel and the sheriff personnel in the same helicopter. We didn't have those during the Cedar Fire, and they would have been invaluable, particularly in the later days of the fire. The first day, of course, was at night. Night flying helicopters, which are available in this year and today. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that that would have helped, but the vast majority of aerial assets are at work primarily during the daytime, and we didn't have those folks during 2003. They were invaluable in later fires.
What areas, if any, do you think that more improvement would be beneficial in? Is there enough funding available?
You could always be better. I think we've got a long way to go with coordination. In our county particularly, we need to really look at the economy of scale. Many small fire agencies don't necessarily make a better fire service delivery system. We work very well together. We have boundary drops countywide. We go across jurisdictional boundaries to put the closest fire engine on the scene of an emergency, regardless of the seal on the door or the patch on the shoulder.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And that does make a lot of sense. But particularly in the unincorporated area, we have many fire departments that are still providing service. It ends up, because of funding and other disparate issues, becomes kind of a haves and have-nots kind of thing.
Yes.
And I think the economy of scale and an overarching fire delivery coordination agency of some sort really is needed in our county.
What are your thoughts about the county fire authority that's been forming up? In theory, there's a lot of benefit to having a coordinated agency. On the other hand, we've heard from some of the rural fire agencies that said after they started being taken over by the CFA, they had more dark days and station closures. There was a death the other night in Hakumba, a medical call where it took a very long time because of a station closure to get there.
I think fire folks need to work together to develop that model. I don't think that's a model that can come from one place and one size fits all. There's over 50 departments in San Diego County. Many of those are in the unincorporated area. You have to work together to kind of develop a community-based fire protection delivery system that meets all the needs. We always need more funding. Every government agency needs more funding to do a better job for our citizens. This is about the community. This is about the citizen who pays his taxes. And I think as long as we keep focusing on the taxpayer and what services they're getting is the most important thing in our business. And when we focus on that, that's when we provide the best service.
Of the people who lost homes or businesses in the Cedar Fire, in your area, Lakeside, how many of those folks have been able to rebuild, go on with their lives?
I think about 90% of the folks have rebuilt or at least had some disposition on their property. And like I said, we had just about 300 homes destroyed just in the fire district.
Wow.
Of course, thousands total.
Countywide.
We wish 100% of the people were back and their lives were back as they were in 2003. But I think it's safe to say that the folks that wanted to return have, the folks who wanted to sell and leave have, and there's some lingering ones that are perhaps stuck in a insurance situation, or maybe they've just chosen not to do that, or age or infirmity or injury have caused them not to take advantage of some of the issues. I think there's probably multiple reasons why one hasn't rebuilt their home.
What is the most important lesson to be learned from the Cedar Fire, Chief Parr?
I think the most important lesson is that there are thousands of homes in the wildland-urban interface in San Diego County, which arguably is the most fire-prone county of the 58 counties in California. We have historically the largest fires in California's history in San Diego County. They are disastrous and deadly. We need to make sure that the folks who live in that wildland-urban interface and even the fringe areas of our suburban areas recognize that fire is one of those things that is part of our lives, and they have to look at it as a natural disaster. It's going to happen, and they need to prepare for it just like they would for earthquake emergencies where they have food, water, and those things on hand.
Good advice. For all the changes and all the improvements that we've seen, do you believe another Cedar Fire could happen again?
Yes. I'm sorry to say, I think it will happen again. If you've been to Wildcat Canyon of late, it's 10 years and the fuel is back. It's getting big, and it's going to get bigger over the next 20 or 30 years if we don't have a fire. We've put more people in the wildland-urban interface since then. However, those homes that are going there are much, much better homes. They're all sprinklered, more solid. They're built to a higher construction levels. They have water on the site. So the homes that we're putting there are much safer for our residents. Nevertheless, when you live in the backcountry or even on the fringes of the backcountry, one needs always to be prepared for the next wildfire.
Kathy Castle of Lakeside is a Cedar Fire survivor and community leader who has helped many others to rebuild their lives. Kathy and her husband Dave co-founded the Cedar Fire Rebuild Resource Group to help the survivors of the Cedar Fire. Kathy, you and your family were camping in Ocotillo Wells when you got word of the Cedar Fire.
I received a phone call early in the morning letting me know that our house was on fire. My teenage daughter was home. Originally, I was fearful that it was something happening to the kids. We just believed it was just our house. We had no idea that the Cedar Fire was happening. My daughter got out of the house and called her brother and my sister-in-law, and then they ran over. We were luckier than some families who had nothing but the pajamas or the clothes they were wearing. So I did have some family heirlooms and a few family photo albums.
When you decided to come back, did you realize the scope of this disaster?
We still didn't. We were driving home. We were told not to come down 67. So we had to go the back way over to 8. And we didn't really have cell phone reception. The radios really weren't announcing any disasters. If anything, it was always about Scripps Ranch area.
When you finally reached Interstate 8 and looked to the west, what did you see?
Our jaw dropped. The mushroom clouds of smoke was overwhelming. And then we knew, no, this was much bigger than just our neighborhood. We met up with my kids and we're happy to see that they were okay. And then we drove to the house and pretty much there was just a fireplace standing. Everything else was collapsed in and burnt.
That must have been just emotionally devastating. How did you feel when you saw that?
You just kind of go numb. I don't even remember having any distinct feelings. It was just shock and grateful that my kids were okay.
Now, it took you 2.5 years or so before you were able to finally rebuild. How did you get by? Where were you living?
At the beginning, we were living with our father-in-law, but because of our animals, and we wanted to be able to oversee the rebuilding process, we purchased a fifth wheel and moved it onto our property, hooked it up to the electrical and water, and we basically camped for 2.5 years. And
so that camping trip got extended.
It just took a while. We thought, oh, we'd be able to just jump right in, but there was just so many details to take care of.
David had been through a tragedy in his past. His parents had lost their home to a fire a decade earlier. Were there lessons that he learned from what they went through? What was the genesis of starting the Cedar Fire Rebuild Resource Group?
Absolutely. We learned that dealing with insurance was an arduous process, and we knew it was going to take some time. And we also knew that you kind of just have to always look forward and keep moving forward, not do a bunch of should have done this and should have done that. At that time, there was a building crunch going on. You know, it was at the peak of building in San Diego. Resources were thin. General contractors were hard to find.
What were some of the tangible things that your group was able to do to help the fire survivors?
In the beginning, my husband's goal was that we would pool our resources, make purchases together to get a bigger discount. But we soon found out that that just wasn't going to work. There were some people that were already on the rebuilding road, and there were some people who were still digging through their ashes. So we found just sharing our stories, just knowing that we weren't alone, that we could work and support each other. We also shared resources in knowledge. One person would find a really good deal on, say, windows. Another person would say, hey, I just heard Home Depot's giving a discount. So our group turned into a resource rebuilding support group.
Now, you've mentioned that the majority of the fire victims did not feel that the insurance companies were as fair with them as one might have hoped. What things can people do to maximize the chances that they will get the most possible coverage from their insurance company?
Knowledge. Research. Learn exactly what the words mean on your insurance policy. Don't take the word of your insurance agent.
Full replacement and making sure that you've updated those policy limits through the years.
Make sure that the valuations that they're using are appropriate. The value to rebuild your house, the cost of living.
What about proving what you lost?
One of the tasks the insurance company assigns you is to list everything you have, but it's almost impossible.
I remember interviewing survivors of the Cedar Fire. One that stands out in my mind was a man who went around with a video camera and videotaped every wall and every room. He pulled open every drawer. And so he was able to collect the maximum that the insurance policy would allow, whereas his neighbors were far less fortunate.
Yes, I would strongly suggest everyone either videotape or document what you have and then either put it on the cloud or give it to a relative off-site.
Are there people who to this day have not been able to rebuild who want to rebuild?
There are some people who are still in the process of rebuilding.
So 10 years, it's taken an entire decade. Why is that?
Some of it is dealing with insurance, and then some of it is their choice in how they rebuild. Maybe their resources are limited, and so they have to actually do the physical labor themselves. So they're just basically building on the weekends. There's some areas that at one point the county said, you can no longer have your trailer in here and you need to either get a building permit or move on. There are some that just decided it was just too much work to try to rebuild. And so they moved to just another area. They still own the property and it sits vacant. I think if you were to drive around, if you saw a slab sitting on the ground and nothing else around it, more than likely it was a Cedar Fire that chose not to build.
One of the things that I found truly inspiring is the positive spirit that so many fire survivors seem to have. They seem to find an inner strength, especially when it happens to entire communities.
It's been my experience, and it's for the most part, most of the other fire families that we've met. It's kind of the American way. You just are resourceful and you build bigger and better and you look for the silver lining. I've had amazing people come into my life. I had strangers handing me money or resources. My husband and I were so overwhelmed with the support that we received, we wanted to give back. And we knew in our lifetime there was no way we could monetarily pay people back. Mm-hmm. So that we chose that we wanted to give back in other ways. And I reached out to Robin Clegg, who was starting the East County Fire Relief Center, and I said that I wanted to help her start that office. The Fire Relief Center was established specifically to reach out to all the fire families and get them the resources that they needed. The place where fire families could go and say, we don't have any clothing. Okay, here, this is what you can do. This is where you can go. Yeah.
You're also involved in the Cedar Fire Historic Monument.
At the Lakeside Fire Department, we will be dedicating a piece of property that they are donating to the community to develop a historic monument. We're hoping to focus on the rebuilding and the regrowth that has happened, the lessons learned from the Cedar Fire, but also remember those families who lost family members.
People across East County, well, a big thank you to you and your husband and the many others who came out and got involved working through your own losses to help others.
The time and energy that David and I put into Cedar Fire has been paid back in more ways than I could even begin to count. My kids bought me a personalized license plate that says the Phoenix, risen from the ashes. And so that's been our philosophy, is that we were just going to continue to rise from the ashes bigger and better.
Cedar Fire survivor Sandra Millers-Young has authored a book titled The Fire Outside My Window. It chronicles her family's narrow escape from the flames, but goes on to provide a comprehensive account of the fire's toll throughout our region, capturing stories that are both heartwarming and heart-wrenching. Ultimately, Younger has rebuilt her home in Lakeside. Like iron forged in a fire, she has arisen stronger from the ashes of her past. We'll close our special program on the Cedar Fire today by reading words from Younger's book, describing what she, like so many other survivors, have come to learn. Fire is a paradox, both terrifying and splendid, polluting and cleansing, demonic and holy. Sometimes it acts as a servant, sometimes tyrant, sometimes midwife, sometimes murderer. Fire gives and fire takes. It can light our way forward. It can erase our past. Neither creature nor creator, it is physics only, a scientific phenomenon, unliving, unfeeling. Yet fire breathes, it moves, it grows, it reacts, and in the end, it dies. Fire cast abroad is like a horse unbroken. It may be corralled, even gentled, but ease up on the bit, and it will bolt, gallop where it wills, with the wind at its back laying on the whip. Once loosed, it cares for no one, needs no one. All that it touches turns to fodder, and the more it consumes, the faster it runs. Everything normal, everything known, can fall beneath those hoofbeats, and the trail they leave is marked by smoke and tears. Sometimes it seems the wildest fires run with purpose, but whether malevolent or capricious, who can tell? One house is spared, another crumbles into ashes. It even seems, sometimes, that fire does us a favor, burning away all that is false, revealing all that is true and good and essential, all that in normal times we mistake for miracles. And sometimes, digging through the ashes of what has been, we find not what we hope to find, a relic intact, however small, but something better, a touchstone to what could be, a key waiting to be turned. We thank the many people who shared their memories with us of this historic event. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM. We'll be back soon.
for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.